and the opinions given by the individual host and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Para-X, its affiliates, or its sponsors.
Step outside of your comfort zone. See the world with a whole new perspective. Join us and experience the unexplained on The Paranormal View.
And welcome, everybody, right here to The Paranormal View on the Para-X Radio Network. I want to thank everybody for taking the time to be with us tonight, those in the chat room and those listening from around the world. We appreciate each and every one of you. If you do have questions tonight, you can private chat to either Ceiling Cat, Cat Cup.
It's a coffee cup.
It's a coffee cup, cat cup. Or myself, Henry Foyster, and we will get those questions right over to our guest tonight. Also, if you're listening from somewhere else other here than here in the chat room, if you want to come over and be with all these lovely, friendly people here in the chat room and interact with them and with us, you can go to para-x.com, click on the live chat button. It'll put you in the room with all these people. But if you have questions and you don't want to come over, you can still ask questions by sending it to theparanormalview@gmail.com and just put attention question and we will get those answered for you. Other than that, there are lots of other ways also that you can still contact us. Is that right, Kat?
Yes. So you can also tweet over messages to us on at Paraview Radio on Twitter, and I will answer those, as well as message us on Facebook, as many people already have. And that is going to be at facebook.com/theparanormalview, all one phrase.
All right. And tonight we have with us Kat Kloko. She is back.
They let me back into the country.
And we have Barbara Duncan with us.
I tunneled in.
She tunneled in.
I flew in.
Now, we have a great guest with lots and lots of great stories, and it's going to take up the whole 2 hours, and we still won't even get close to being done. So, Kat's going to go ahead and introduce our guest.
Oh, yes. So I'm very happy to welcome her back. This is the third time she has been on the Paranormal View. And this is, we're welcoming back Barbara Sillery, author of The Haunting of Mississippi, which we'll be talking about tonight, The Haunting of Louisiana, and The Haunting of Cape Cod and the Islands, which I remember speaking to her about back in 2015. She's also a television producer, a writer, and has a big passion for words. And I'm sorry, Barbara, I'm cutting off this. You have so many projects. You're such a busy lady. So I'm just going to highlight these tonight. But thank you for returning to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Oh, yes.
No problem. Because we got lots and lots to talk about.
Yes. So I remember the last time you were on the show, we talked about the haunting of Cape Cod and the islands, because I had just moved to Rhode Island and found the entire thing just fascinating. And then again, we're talking about The Haunting of Mississippi, which is a fantastic book as well, and makes me really want to visit Mississippi now.
I was a little skeptical at first when I tackled the Mississippi project, because I had just done The Haunting of Louisiana, and I thought there's just no way that Mississippi is going to have the number of ghosts that I found, or ghost stories that I found in Louisiana. And indeed, it was just fascinating. I just got in my car, took a road trip, went from town to town, and discovered some of the most amazing stories and most amazing places.
So how did you find these places to write about?
Well, a few of them, you know, for example, in Natchez, there's a lot that are well known. And then it would be sort of word of mouth. Once I would talk to someone, they would say, oh, well, have you been here or have you been there? For example, when I went to Greenville, because I had heard that there was a ghost of a former Army sergeant haunting the old armory, which is now the Greenville Convention and Visitors Bureau. When I was done there, Wesley Smith, who was the director of the time, said, well, now you need to go over to Lake Washington, because there's just two fascinating old mansions there that have incredible stories with them. So it was sort of, you know, like I said, it was pretty much word of mouth once I got started.
So you've been to every place that's in the book, or most of the places?
I never write about a place unless I go there in person, unless I do interview the owner, visitors, one of the museum guides. So, yeah, I always want to get the story firsthand. So while I'll do a lot of research before I go, I always want to hear from the people in the community what they have to say.
Well, then, I tell you what, you've had some incredible experiences in, because some of these places look pretty awesome.
They really are. They really are. And, they're, you know, because we're talking about places that are 100, 200 years old, there are multiple layers of who lived there, what happened there, that, you know, just seems to go on and on and on. So a lot of times I felt like I really just kind of got just a little ways into it. Like if I went back three or four more times, I would probably uncover more.
Now, there's some places in the book that we was already discussing about, and some that Kat had wanted to talk about, and some that Barbara wanted to talk about. So, Kat, why don't you go ahead and start off?
I think we should start at the beginning. And okay. The beginning would be McRaven House in Vicksburg, Mississippi. And this is the first chapter in the book. And I found it very interesting. The entire history, of course, is fascinating about each one of these mansions. And did they all go through Katrina and basically survive the storm?
McRaven House, some of them didn't. Beauvoir, Mississippi, for example, was pretty much destroyed by Katrina because it was right there on the Gulf Coast. But it has come back, and it's better than ever. McRaven House, actually, when I wrote about it, was when I did the research, was pre-Katrina. And at the time that I was there, it was up for sale. So it was not open to the public. They were looking for a buyer. It is opened now. They do once again offer tours. But at the time that I was there, I had to get the caretaker to give me a private tour of this incredible place, this incredible historic house.
Yeah, and it seems to be still occupied by some spectral residents. So could you go into depth of who is said to haunt McRaven House and some of its history?
It has multiple ghosts, each from a different time period. And if you look at McRaven House from the side, it's like looking at a series of steps, because each successive owner, starting at the very bottom in the frontier section and then working its way up, added a new section to the front. And so each section seems to have its own ghost. And two of the last two women to live in the house were two spinster sisters that apparently were into hoarding. And when they died, and then the house was purchased and opened to the public for tours, those were the first two ghosts that the caretaker told me about that he personally encountered. And he said when they did tours of the house, he would sit in the lobby, and then another tour guide would take the visitors through the house. And he said he was sitting there one day in the lobby in a chair. And he said he had had a bad night. He was very tired. And he said he started to doze off when all of a sudden he just got hit and almost knocked out of his chair. And he then believes, and when he looked around, of course, there was no one there. The tour guide was upstairs. He said there's no way she could have run back down the stairs again and hit him. And why would she do that? So today he believes that the person that hit him and knocked him off the chairs was one of the two sisters who was telling him to wake up and pay attention.
I love how sometimes ghosts, I know people will write off ghosts as just kind of I almost say, I've talked to people who think ghosts are more like a pet in a house, but I like how these two sisters have a lot of character and still continue to haunt the place and put people in line when they need to be in line.
Well, I've heard that, you know, you should expect spirits to have the same personality in the afterlife that they did in life, that they're not going to change personalities all of a sudden and become something else. So whatever they did when they were alive, they seem to be prone to act the same way in the afterlife. And Annie and Ella were very eccentric women. They were the last of the Murray children to live in McRaven House. And they were just known for their very peculiar habits. They said that after they took over the house, one of the things they found were just tons and tons of sardine cans, because the sisters, it was very hard to heat a house this old. And so they actually moved their bedroom into the dining room where the fireplace was, and they seemed to live on a diet of sardines.
Right.
And they're just kind of unusual people that have lived in the house over the years. And then one of the former owners, John Bob, who lived in it during the Siege of Vicksburg. And what happened with him and why his ghost appears to still be there is that he was actually murdered on the grounds. And apparently during the Siege of Vicksburg, there were some drunken Union soldiers supposedly wandering on his property, and he yelled at them, and they apparently came back another night and just shot him. And so his spirit, his ghost, is said to still be seen up on the upper gallery. He apparently had a fondness for smoking a pipe, and so people have said they can smell his pipe smoke through the house. So, you know, it's just different layers of different ghosts walking through the house. Some of the Civil War soldiers, if you go to the back of McRaven House, it's just incredible. You can actually see the trench that was dug by the Confederate soldiers right before the Union soldiers were coming along the railroad tracks, and they made this sort of their staging grounds, and there was a huge battle that took place there. And so it's really quite eerie to be standing not just on a battlefield, but actually to see the trench where these Confederate soldiers were gunned down. And there are two grave sites on the property that one of the later owners put a marker there, and these Civil War soldiers are said sometimes to appear in photographs that visitors to the grounds have taken in the past.
Oh, wow.
That would be interesting.
That would be a lot like when you visit Gettysburg, where you can get phantom soldiers in your photos.
Right, right. And then there's the spirit, I always love it when I hear about the women. And there's the spirit of Mary Elizabeth Howard, who died giving childbirth in the house. And apparently, again, one of the other theories that I've heard is that when a mother dies in a house, or when her child dies in a house, she will often come back looking for this child. And Mary Elizabeth's child, she died. I'm sorry, let me backtrack a little bit. She died, but the daughter survived. But after the death of the daughter, the father, Elizabeth's husband, moved out of the house because he couldn't bear to stay there, and he moved the daughter away. But Mary Elizabeth, the mother, is said to return because she's looking for her child. She's apparently quite friendly. She often greets the visitors on the second floor where her bedroom used to be. And the tour guides, while they love that Mary Elizabeth is there, they sometimes find it a little annoying, because you know, when you take a tour, the tour guides have certain rooms they want you to go in first. You know, they have a certain order of rooms, and often the tour guide will turn around and realize that the people on the tour are not with them anymore. They've turned into Mary Elizabeth's bedroom. And when they've asked the people, like, why weren't you following? And they're like, oh, well, this lady called us to come over here.
Yeah. I remember reading that in the book.
Yeah, so they like Mary Elizabeth. She's not scary or anything, but she's also blamed for turning the lights on and off at night, and especially when the house was vacant, well, it was up for sale. The caretaker told me that often he would get a call from the police department that the lights were on at McGraven House, and he would say, no, they're not, and he would have to go over there and check, and he would say, yep, somebody turned the lights back on, and he would just always attribute it to Mary Elizabeth, that she was learning some of these newfangled things that were going on in the house, because at the time that she lived there, of course, there weren't electric lights.
That is true, and I could kind of put myself into those shoes, being Mary Elizabeth lived, what, in the 1840s?
Yeah,
and that was even before, well, you had gas lighting, but the fact that you could turn on all the lights in a room with a single flick of a switch had to be amazing. So I could just see her going up and down and turning them on and off, like, and on and off.
With computers today, you know, we're all trying new things all the time. We're amazed that we can do all these things with our iPads and our cell phones and our computers. So why wouldn't a spirit who has come back to the house where they lived and sees new things in there, why wouldn't they be curious?
Right.
I mean, they're no different than we are.
That's true.
Again, it's personality.
Yes. And she must have been very curious.
Well, sure. Here's this strange-looking objects on the wall that she's never seen before, and she starts to play with them. I mean,
yes.
No harm there whatsoever, other than, you know, people going, hey, wait a minute, there's not supposed to be lights on there in the middle of the night. And then at the other ghosts that are supposed to be there is that incredible story about the original builders of the house, the Glass family, who were actually not very nice people. Apparently they would go on raids on the Natchez Trace. And then the story or the legend that's associated with them is they made a raid. They were being chased. They were trying to get back to McRaven House, and they realized they were surrounded. And so Andrew Glass's wife slit his throat. He was wounded, and she didn't want him crying out. He didn't want to be taken a prisoner. And so to keep him quiet and not to expose the rest of the gang, she slit his throat.
That is hardcore.
That's what's
That's like, okay. I mean, you know, taking one for the team.
For the team? That's the ultimate one. But yeah, I was reading through that and I'm like, Cece got her pirate story.
Yeah.
And then Leland French, who was the last owner before it was reopened again. He had some wonderful stories to say about I think he kind of believed it was the spirit of Andrew Glass that was doing it to him. He was in the house after a tour had gone through, noticed a spot on the floor. He's trying to clean it up. He's down on his hands and knees, and he feels a foot on his back that's holding him down to the ground.
Oh.
So, yeah, he said, you know, either it was one of the Union soldiers, the spirits of one of them, or he kind of thought maybe it might even be Andrew Glass, you know, just obviously not a happy camper
right.
at all.
No.
Man.
I'd say so.
I wouldn't be either if somebody cut my throat.
Yeah. So, and then there's also, it was used as a staging grounds, the house went along the Trail of Tears when the Native Americans were being removed under the Indian Removal Act that was made by Andrew Jackson. And so, you know, it wasn't a very healthy situation. There were a number of the tribe that died on the grounds. And so other potential spirits on the property could be those of the Native Americans who died on the grounds. So it's just, you know, from every single period in McRaven's house history, there seems to be some lingering spirits.
Wow.
I wonder if they're aware of one another.
That's a good question. I don't, in all of the stories that have been shared with me, I didn't hear anyone do kind of a crossover.
Mm-hmm.
They all seem to be very, very separate. And as you go through the house, you actually feel like you're walking through a time capsule. if you start in the front, the most modern of the eras, and then you're actually going downhill. So you're going downhill, down steps to each section of the house, and you feel like you've entered another world. And it's decorated for each period. I think it was a very conscious thing that they left each section of the house to the furniture and the artifacts the way it would have been in that time period. So again, as you walk through, you really have this sense that I'm walking through time. I'm going backwards another century. And the artifacts, I've never been in a historic home that has had so many artifacts. It's really hard for your eyes to focus because there's just so much to look at. Wow. And then the last owners, the two sisters, the two Murray sisters, they never threw anything away. So everything's there. Absolutely. Wow. So that's wonderful. Because a lot of times you go to these historic sites and they really don't have much left that's original. You know, they might have a reproduction or they may have gotten something that was similar to what had been in the house. So in this one, you really feel like you're connecting to the people that live there. You know, you really have a true sense of what their lives were like and what happened to them.
Wow. And actually, we have a question from chat, which is from Cat in Chat. Awesome name, but she's not me. But we're both named Cat. And she asks, why is it called McRaven House?
You know, that's a great question. And I actually don't know the answer because... not the name of any of the people that live there.
Yeah. So, wow. Good one, Kat. And I guess McRaven, I'm going to be honest. When I hear McRaven, I think of McDonald's and then I want a hamburger. But,
you know, I think of the Edgar Allan Poe and right. That's the Raven.
I
don't think it's a Scottish name.
No, I think it's a good... let's try to be eye-catching and somewhat spooky at the same time name.
Could be.
Yeah, to me, it definitely sounds spooky. And I remember when I went there and the caretaker had to literally unlock this padlock. And then we had to walk through this little mini forest. And then when we got to the front door, there's this knocker on the front door in the shape of a woman's hand, a white knocker. And I was just like, ooh.
Oh, wow.
I don't know if I would do that or not.
Odd little bit. You're like, okay, that's a little bit creepy. I'm not sure I want to go inside. Again, I don't know where it came from, and the caretaker told me it had always been there. So at what point, who put it on there, I don't know. But it was odd.
Wow.
What I loved about this story is it reminded me a lot of the pyramids in South America. They're now finding that there's pyramids on top of pyramids on top of pyramids, and this is sort of doing the same thing. It's like it's building history on top of each other.
I mean, we think of ourselves as the first or maybe second generation of recyclers, but recycling has always gone on, and materials were not easy to get, you know, to fell a tree, to make bricks, all those kind of things, you know, were very labor intensive. So it makes sense that when you're remodeling a house, you use parts and pieces of what was there before.
Yeah, I've heard that a lot of times when people had cabins and stuff like that, if they wanted to move somewhere else, they would take the cabin apart and take the boards with them because otherwise they'd have to be doing a whole lot more cutting somewhere else.
Right. Or going to an area where it didn't have a lot of timber.
Right.
So, again, we have not invented too many things. All we're doing is borrowing from the past and building on the past, which is great.
Oh, yeah. The other story in there was really interesting, and that was the story of John H. Bob's murder.
Yeah. That's the one I was talking about a few minutes ago that was actually, he had apparently become very disgruntled during the siege of Vicksburg with these Union soldiers who he felt were trespassing on his property. I mean, it was already under siege, so I don't know where he really thought he stood a chance, but apparently he did yell at them, and they came back, and they shot him in the back quite a number of times. So, yeah, obviously you can see why his spirit would be back. You know, this was his house. He was murdered there. And so he's kind of back once again, repeating the same behavior that he did in the past, which is keeping an eye on his property. And probably, maybe not too happy that all these new visitors are walking through his house.
I wonder if he's ever tried to throw a brick at anybody.
I've heard that he's been harmful. Again, maybe he's the one who put his foot on the back of Leon French, who was down on the floor. So there's several candidates for ghosts, disgruntled ghosts there at McGraven House. So while there are some nice ones like Mary Elizabeth, there are some others I probably wouldn't be too happy if I ran into them.
Oh,
oh yeah.
I can see right now that we're not going to get too many places in this book. With so many stories from each one.
Fascinating with a lot of the, I would say the vast majority of places in Mississippi, is there was never just one ghost. There was multiple spirits in one location.
In the location. Wow.
Yeah.
I guess that means they'll never be alone. They have a drinking buddy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that is if they mix, which, you know, was an interesting question you brought up. I'm going to have to start asking that question more when I go out doing research, is do you think that the ghosts from different time periods interact?
With each other.
With each other, right, with each other.
I haven't heard of anything like that at other places, so it's like each one's in their own time.
Right.
Whatever, so they don't connect with the other ghosts.
I think it depends on places, because the house I live in now was built in 1749, and we have two ghosts in the house. We have a 20-year-old woman that we call Beth, and then we have a late teens kid that I've never given a name to, and they know that each other's around, and they keep out of each other's way.
Oh, interesting.
But Beth is by far the one that is much more interactive with things around the house. Like, she'll move things around my studio, which I'm actually broadcasting from. So, but I think it's unique to each house or each location. And the good question is why.
Yeah, that would be one of those. It's one of those things that, you know, as a writer, I would really like to go to the girls. Can you just sit down with me for like 5 minutes and let me interview you and ask you some questions? Well, I'd like a few answers here.
Your next profession will be ghost mixer. And you can introduce ghosts to each other.
Yeah, there we go. I can have a little party. Like say at McGraven House and say, tonight we're going to have a party. You can all come out together. You can all interact. And, you know, we'll see what you think of each other. That would be fun.
Yeah. That would be interesting. I would love to hear the EVPs from that party.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we've got other places. Do you want to start on another one before we do a break?
One of my other favorites, that was Vicksburg. There's a number of Natchez, Mississippi, and one of my favorites was Linden Plantation, which is a bed and breakfast today. And I had gone there, so I'll tell you my personal experience. I had gone there to, you know, research the history of the house. It apparently has a number of ghosts, all belong to the same family because it has always been in the same family. And I interviewed the owner at the time, which was Jeannie Feltis. She was very, very gracious. Again, it was off season, and so she had said to me the night that I checked in, you can stay in any room that you want to. And for some reason that I can't explain, I chose to stay in one of the smallest bedrooms, which was, the house is an U-shape, and Jeannie's bedroom was all the way to the front of the house. So she was the only other person sleeping there that night. And the room that I chose was all the way to the back on the second floor. And I went up there late, unpacked my suitcase, got into bed. After I got in bed and turned out the light, I heard a little bit of creaking, and I thought, oh, okay, you know, it's an old house. I'm sure the floorboards, you know, once the weight of my foot came off of it, it made a creaking sound, not a big deal. And then I was really, really, really tired, and I was starting to fall asleep, and I was becoming aware that the creaking sound seemed to be going around the bed. You know, at first it was on one side, and then it was at the foot of the bed, and then it was seemed to be coming from the other side of the bed. But again, I was really exhausted and must have fallen asleep somewhere around 2 o'clock in the morning. I realized I was wide awake, sat up in bed. It was a fairly full moon that night, so the room, I could see the moonlight coming through the window. I knew I was awake because I could see my suitcase, I could see the other pieces of furniture, and I kept looking around the room thinking, I wonder what woke me up. I wonder why I'm so wide awake. And as I'm sitting up in bed, looking around, trying to figure out what's going on, to my right, I hear a little voice, and it goes, "Hello." And I'm like, "Oh, well, hello to you too." And I waited and I waited and I waited, and nothing else. Just this one word, "Hello," in a child's voice. The next morning, I go down to breakfast. Jeannie asks me how I slept. I said, "Well, pretty good, except somewhere around 2 o'clock in the morning, I woke up and I heard this child's voice saying, 'Hello.'" And Jeannie goes, "Oh, I forgot to tell you, the room that you're sleeping in was used by the original owner as the schoolroom for the children." So I was like, okay, then I guess I was talking to one of the children. But, you know, it was great, but it was disappointing at the same time because the conversation did not continue. It was just this one little word greeting. And definitely a child's voice. Absolutely a child's voice.
Hmm. Oh, wow. Yeah, but
I wasn't frightened because, you know, it was a little child. It wasn't trying to hurt me or scare me. Just kind of warm and friendly.
And hard and to polite. Tell if it was residual or whether it was really trying to interact with you?
I can't say. Mm-hmm. I mean, like you said, there was no further attempt for conversation. You know, it was just, you know, "Hi, I'm here," I guess, kind of thing. And that was it. You know, maybe the child had died there. There had been some of family members that had died, but it had always been in the same family. And Jeannie herself is very comfortable with all of the ghosts that are there, including the original owner, Jane Connor. And she even says she visits with her father-in-law, Dick, who died in the house, and that Dick hangs around from time to time.
Wow.
And he's buried in Natchez Cemetery, and Jeannie has said, you know, that cemetery is really, really crowded, so I know I'll have to be cremated, and I want to be buried between Dick, my father-in-law, and my husband. However, she said, "I'm not going to be staying there. I know I will be back to Linden, and I'll be joining the ghosts at Linden."
Wow. Well, you know, I've heard things like that before, where you'll hear one word where they're saying something. You'll hear one word, and you won't get any more interaction. I've caught EVPs like that, or know people that has, and they get nothing else from them. So I don't know whether it's just like a open up in time to where they can just for a second, they see you and they say something. And then it's like the door closes and either they can't come back or you just don't hear them anymore. So,
yeah. I mean, sometimes I feel like, oh, I didn't say or ask the right question to prompt the spirit to keep talking.
Yeah.
You know, so you always feel like, oh, I should have tried harder. What could I have done to encourage this? But Jeannie, the night before, had told me a lot about the other spirits, her father-in-law and the original owner, Mrs. Connor, she had never mentioned a child. So when this happened to me, I was not prepared to ask, you know, are you so-and-so? Are you the daughter of... It just... And I didn't know that I was sleeping in the former schoolroom either. So I had no reference to be able to make further contact.
Wow.
Yeah, that's kind of like how a lot of, I guess, encounters with just the paranormal, not necessarily ghosts, are. It's sudden and you're unprepared, but it's always fascinating when it happens.
When it happens, there was a guide at Mary Hope in Meridian, Mississippi, and she said much the same thing to me. She said, I thought I would be prepared, you know, because I had heard all these stories about, you know, the two ghosts that are here. And so I thought I would be prepared when I saw them to ask the questions. She said, instead, when I did see our ghost, I was sort of dumbfounded. And by the time I realized I was looking at something out of the ordinary, it was gone.
Yeah,
exactly.
I think we're going to go ahead and take a quick break before we continue on with these fascinating stories from fascinating places in the book. And let's see. I believe, Barbara, do you want to take us out or bring us back?
Take us out first.
Okay, Barbara's going to take us out, and Kat gets to bring us back.
All right.
Well, folks, you're listening to The Paranormal View here on Para-X Radio, and tonight we're talking with Barbara Sillery, author of The Haunting of Mississippi. We'll be right back after a few messages.
Don't go away. The Paranormal View will be right back.
Ideal Event Management is your top-rated paranormal events organizer. They represent some of the biggest names in the paranormal community. Whether you need help putting together your event, looking for a celebrity, or just want to pump up the excitement, Ideal Event Management can help you. Contact Mark at 413-478-3642 or check out their website at idealeventmanagement.com. You'll be glad you did.
It's always time for the dead to shine in Hollywood. The legendary Dearly Departed Tours has stepped up their ghostly game by offering the Hollywood Ghosts and Legends Walking Tour. Dearly Departed has long been an orb of hope in the paranormal world, having been featured on television's Haunted History and Haunted Collector. Their terrible tales have been made infamous in Marla Brooks' The Ghosts of Hollywood books. The new Ghosts and Legends Tour is a 10-block, 70-minute dusk-time stroll down the boulevard of broken dreams. You'll be guided through the golden age of Hollywood and see where the unearthly Bela Lugosi, Lon Chaney, and the calamitous Black Dahlia are still said to linger. You'll see Hollywood's gothic hotels, legendary theaters, and restaurants, never forgetting their permanent occupants. No stranger to investigations, Dearly Departed Tours has first-hand knowledge of some of these hauntings. For details of the Hollywood Ghosts and Legends Walking Tour, find Dearly Departed Tours on Facebook, dearlydepartedtours.com, or call 1-855-600-DEAD.
From the author of the Ghost of Hollywood series and Workplace Spells comes a book for all lovers of pets, Animal Spells and Magic by Marla Brooks. Learn how to choose your next pet according to their astrological sign. Explore animal superstitions. Learn 25 magic spells for your pets and get instructions on creating your own spells. Learn who to call upon and what to use to cast these spells. Include special chapters by Reverend Tim Shaw, Psychic to the Stars Kenny Kingston, Psychic Medium Victoria Gross, Animal Communicator Dinah Roseberry, and Shaman Willie Windwalker Gibson. This is the perfect book for all animal lovers. Animal Spells and Magic by Marla Brooks. For details on how to get your copy of this amazing new book, go to www.schifferbooks.com
or check out Marla Brooks online at www.marlabrooks.com. This would make the perfect gift for the animal lover in your life. Go to www.schifferbooks.com or ask about it at your local bookstore.
So, Tim, around here at Para-X, we're considered oldies because we've been here so long, right?
You know, yeah, but, you know, there's nothing wrong with oldies. In fact, you know what? I really love oldies.
Well, yeah, me too. I mean, it kind of takes me back to a time when my cauldron had training wheels and the Black Cat Lounge was called the Black Kitten Lounge. Sometimes I miss the good old days.
Sis, there's no need to miss them at all, because all you'll have to do is turn on and listen to Rock with the Shock.
Rock with the Who?
No, 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 little sis. No, 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 not the Who, the Shock.
I found it at last! Marla's sacred cauldron. This is the legendary artifact that has been whispered about in hushed tones for hundreds of years, and now it's mine! All mine!
Who dares defile the sanctity of my castle walls? Step away from the cauldron, you impertinent, muddy metal maltworm.
Never! I've spent half my lifetime trying to discover your age-old secret of stirring the cauldron.
Oh, for Merlin's sake, that's no deep, dark secret. Just tune into the Para-X Radio Network Thursday nights at 9 o'clock Eastern for more cauldron stirring than you can shake a wand at.
Oh, well, in that case, I guess I don't need to take up any more of your time, so I guess I'll be going.
Not just yet. We've got a little unfinished business to take care of.
That's Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks every Thursday night at 9 p.m. Eastern on the Para-X Radio Network.
Hi, I am John Zaffis, and you are listening to Paranormal View on the Para-X Radio Network.
Para-X Radio presents Real Persons of Genius.
Real Persons of Genius.
Today, we salute you, Mr. and Mrs. Para-X show host.
Mr. and Mrs. Para-X show host.
Armed with nothing more than a laptop and a microphone, you hit the air to scare the bejesus out of your audience.
What the hell was that noise?
Like a dog peeing on a fire hydrant, you always whet our appetite for more.
I just can't get enough.
Whether it's witches, ghosts, fairies, or Bigfoot, we admire your ability to set aside reality and believe anything anyone tells you.
Seek professional help.
So the next time you're kneeling in front of your 8x10 glossy of Dave and Tom lighting a candle, remember, if it wasn't for you, I might be able to sleep without the lights on.
Mr. and Mrs. Para-X Soho.
Para-X Radio Network, powered by CBS.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Paranormal View radio show with your hosts, myself, Kat Cloco, Henry Foister, and Cece, the ceiling cat, Barbara Duncan. And we're welcoming back our guest, Barbara Sillery, to the show.
Hi, everyone.
Hello.
And we have people listening from everywhere. Is that right, Barbara?
We sure do. Tonight we have listeners in the United States, the United Kingdom, Canada, Singapore, Costa Rica. Unknown is back and followed by Anonymous.
Oh my!
There's a different one?
Oh. Yeah. Oh.
Wow. Well, I feel special. Thank you, Unknown and Anonymous, wherever you may be, wherever you are listening. Thank you for listening to the show.
Yay. Wow. We've been talking about a couple of places here in the book, The Haunting of Mississippi, and some great stories and great places that you've been to. There's one that has some real interesting stories. And
if there's one?
It's the one that we're going to talk about.
Okay.
And if you're listening and you want to see photos of these places, you can look them up online. And the one we're going to be talking about is Anchuca. It's A-N-C-H-U-C-A.
Well, gesundheit, Henry.
Yeah. But it has some real interesting stories in it, how they found some things, because it's a real old place. You want to tell us about that?
Yeah. Now, there's several Anchucas in the United States, but this one, the one that I'm referring to in the book, is actually in Vicksburg, Mississippi. And it is, today, it is a wonderful bed and breakfast, very, very charming, very, very, very well done. And I had gone there and I had met both of the owners, Chris Brinkley and Tom Farr, and they immediately began to share some of the stories about the house and some of the things that had happened to them when they took over the bottom of the house. And they say that children are very sensitive to spirits, and also apparently so are animals, dogs. And Kat, you might appreciate this because you are definitely a dog lover. I think you mentioned you'd be going to a dog show soon, and you take a lot of wonderful photographs of dogs.
Oh, yes.
And so when Chris and Tom moved into the house, they had to go away, and they asked a friend of theirs who was worked at the local DA's office if she would come and feed their dog Snickers. And she said that was fine, and she got over there one day. And she said, you know, she went to bring food to the dog, and she looked up at the landing. And the house is sort of on a hill, so it slopes downward. The front of the house is at the top of the hill, and then there are steps leading down. And she said she looked up at the landing. Something caught her eye, and she thought to herself, oh, somebody left the window open. The drapes are blowing in the breeze. There's sort of these white drapes. And then she went, oh, no, those are not drapes. That's some kind of figure walking across the landing. And she had been alerted to the movement of these drapes by the dog, Snickers, who was barking and was absolutely out of control at seeing. And she was thinking to herself, I don't know what to do, because I've got to get back to work. I don't want to leave the dog inside. He's obviously scared to death. And after she handled the situation, she said, regrettably, she did leave and then push the dog back in the house, even though he wanted to come back out. And she left this great voicemail on Chris and Tom's message on their voicemail. And they said when they got back, they played it, and it said, I don't know what you all have going on over here, but house sitting is out of the question. I love the dog, I love you, but don't ask me to go in the house by myself ever again.
Oh, wow. One, how that scene played out in my mental theater is actually quite hilarious, but then it goes back into, you see a ghost and you're never prepared for it.
Right. Right. And she had not expected anything whatsoever. She had never heard them, you know, discuss that they might have a ghost or there were strange things going on. They had simply asked her if she would house sit and make sure that their dog Snickers got fed. So, you know, totally caught off guard by what she was seeing and obviously freaked out by what she saw. And they said, you know, clearly she saw something. She's a very trustworthy person. She works for the DA's office. There was no reason for her to make up a story about seeing a ghost in their house. And she was clearly frightened by what she had seen, or startled at the very least by what she has seen.
Now, first reaction was, how could you leave the doggy there?
Well, especially if they knew that there was things going on in the house, you know that animals would be afraid of it.
Well, I think that they see things. I mean, obviously their hearing is different than ours. They hear sounds that we don't hear on levels that we don't hear.
Yeah.
So perhaps they sense things even before we do.
Hmm. Yeah.
Well, now there's another story dealing with some portraits that they now have hanging in the house.
It is the most unusual ghost story I think I have ever heard of. And Chris and Tom were telling me this, that you know the house is beautifully, elegantly decorated. I mean, it's just gorgeous. And they were actually in the hall, and they were hearing the sound that no homeowner wants to hear, and it was a drip, 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 and then a splat of water hitting the carpet. And of course, they immediately go in the dining room to see what it is, and they look up at the ceiling, and they see water coming down from the ceiling. So they run up to the next floor of the house, where there's a bathroom right over the ceiling, and they check the bathroom. Everything's dry. There's no water in the shower. There doesn't seem to be water dripping out of the shower head. They call their plumber, even though it's the weekend, and say, look, it's an emergency. We've got water dripping on our beautiful carpet in the dining room. We've gone up to the second floor. We can't find a leak. The plumber comes over. They've used him in the past. They trust him. He follows exactly the path they did. He goes from the first floor to the second floor, and then he goes up in the attic, and he goes immediately. If you've ever lived in the South, you know, you have, a lot of them have the air conditioning up in the attic, the unit, and you have these drip pans underneath that when the air conditioning unit freezes over, the water will start accumulating in this drip pan, which is why it's there, is to catch the water before it goes down into the rest of the house. The plumber checked the drip pan. It was as dry as a bone. He's standing over the area of where this water is coming into the dining room. He can't find any pipes whatsoever, and the flooring, if you want to call it flooring, of the attic is covered with the insulation, you know, that sort of pinkish insulation, the fiberglass insulation, and he starts digging with it with his bare hands, seeing if he can find something that's damp, you know, where it might be the source of this drip. And as he sticks his hand in, and the owner is standing over him watching him, he puts his hand in and he pulls out this framed portrait. And the owner is just astounded and takes it downstairs to clean it to see what's going on, when the plumber, sort of, I describe it in my book, is like little Jack Horner pulling out the fruit out of the pie, yells, he's got another one. And that he had now found two portraits that were buried under the insulation up in the attic. They take the portraits downstairs, they clean them up, and when they come back downstairs, the plumber comes back in a few minutes and he says, there's no leak up here. I cannot find the source of any leak anywhere. They go into the dining room and the ceiling is no longer dripping. The dripping has stopped. And Tom and Chris told me that ever since that day, they have never had a problem again with water dripping from the ceiling in the dining room. And what they have done is cleaned up these portraits, and these portraits now hang proudly in the front hall. And they believe that the portraits are that of Mr. and Mrs. Hennessy, who were one of the previous owners of the house. And all they can do is conclude that Mr. and Mrs. Hennessy were somehow sending them a message that they wanted to be released from the attic and they wanted to be hung in a place of honor, which they now are.
Now, that's an interesting story. I mean, there's no water coming from anywhere, but it's dripping from the ceiling onto the floor, and there was no pipes or anything leaking.
And to this day, they've never had a problem again, ever.
And as soon as they found the portraits, it stopped.
Yeah.
Right. And Tom even showed me, he said, we haven't completely sealed up the ceiling just in case. So you can see these two little pinprick holes that are up there where they punched the ceiling to see if there was a pipe that had broken. So he said, just in case, we haven't totally patched this over. Plus, it makes for a great story when we tell everybody about it.
Right.
We can point to exactly where this leak started. But just, you know, they never found it through coming through any of the upper floors. Everything else is bone dry.
Wow. Yeah. My reaction when reading this story was, one, it has to be a great riddle for some physicist to figure out how water has just appeared out of nowhere and managed to still ruin a few carpets and drywall. But also, what is it with ghosts wanting and having people pay a lot of attention to their portraits, because although this way of getting attention is different, I've never heard of a story like this before. I've heard of ghosts using their portraits as a way and means of gaining attention in locations they're haunting.
Right, right. You know, where something happens that draws you to the portrait. And in this case, something unbelievable, something that's, you know, physically shouldn't be possible, caused this plumber to dig into the insulation and pull out two portraits.
Yep.
And
yeah.
They never would have known they were there if it hadn't been for this leak in the ceiling.
Now, having dealt with stuff like this, I know that sometimes clear liquid isn't necessarily water. Did anybody actually taste it to see if it really was just water?
Again, you guys are asking the best questions. I did not ask them if they tasted to make sure it was water. They just all described it as water, and so I was like, okay. And it made sense when you're talking about pipe dripping. And yeah, I never even thought to say, well, what would you think it would be?
It could be a number of different things, one would think. And I agree. I mean, objects can appear and disappear and appear elsewhere. Why couldn't water or ectoplasm or whatever it is that you want to call it disappear from one place and reappear in another?
Yeah, this is true. This is true. People always talk about that, you know, if a silverware or a candlestick was in one room and suddenly it's in another room and they have no explanation of how it got from, you know, room X to room Y. So that does, that kind of poltergeist activity I have come across over and over again at various sites where people say that's why they believe that there is a spirit of some, of a former occupant now back in the house because things are out of place and that's all they can attribute it to.
Wow.
It's kind of odd too, don't you think, that the portraits would be in the attic and somebody would just nonchalantly throw insulation on top of it?
Yes, you kind of wonder how it happened in the first place, but then if you've ever been around workmen that are doing certain tasks, it's like, you know, we do a lot of things by rote, and we just go ahead and do them, and a lot of times when we're doing them, we're not necessarily giving it our full attention. We've done it so often, blowing insulation, they just, you know, point a hose and blow insulation, so maybe they're not looking at something that's, you know, and I don't know exactly the position of the portraits. If they were upside down and the backs of them were brown, they're not that large. We're not talking about, you know, something that's 20 by 20. They're smaller sized portraits. Maybe someone wouldn't have even, you know, just thought it was a piece of paper, never having thought to turn them over to see that, you know, what it was, that it was actually, you know, this beautiful oval frame. Wow. But, you know, from the backside, it wouldn't look like anything at all.
Well, it could have been dark in the attic when they were either blowing the insulation in or just rolling it in, and they probably never even noticed anything.
And it's not the insulator's job.
Oh, true. to clear the attic, yes.
You know, it's his job to get in there and get out of there quickly and you know, not necessarily be rooting around looking for something.
Wow. There's one that, and I don't know how much there is in the story other than the story about the two people who had lived in the house. It was called the Williams Gingerbread House. Short little.
I mean, another one of those incredible freak accidents, someone dying in the house. The husband and wife lived in the house, had no children. They did adopt one of their, I think it was a cousin's child, but pretty much they lived there alone. And as they got older, the wife had trouble getting around, and she was confined to a wheelchair. Her husband had an elevator installed in the house. And unfortunately, again, just absolutely freak accident. She was upstairs, wanted to go downstairs, push the button for the elevator. backed her wheelchair into the elevator, only the elevator was still on the bottom floor, and she and her wheelchair, you know, fell down the story, and she later died a few days later of her injuries in this fall. And now, supposedly, it is her ghost that people feel is in the house, is still there. And, you know, other than the tragic story of her death, this was a very loving couple who really cared for each other. So it's not surprising to me that they would want to be back in a place where they both had so many happy memories.
And when you look at the place on the outside, it looks pretty creepy.
It does. It actually sits, it's in Meridian, Mississippi, and there is a beautiful white pillared mansion in front of it, which has its own ghost. And this one is sort of halfway to the back of it, to the side. And I think it was just the style at the time, but it's a quasi-Victorian, painted brown. The windows are small. When you're inside, it does seem a little bit dark and dingy. But again, you know, it wasn't in an era where you had these big, expansive views. So the house itself, yes, the first time that I saw it when I went, so here's this beautiful white-pillared mansion, and then you kind of go around the corner to the back of the grounds, and here's this sort of dingy-looking Victorian, and you're kind of like, And it's not, you know, like a lot of these historic sites, there's not a lot of money to keep up the grounds, to keep everything with a fresh coat of paint. So the society that owns it has been struggling in recent times to raise the funds to restore things fully and then maintain it.
Wow. Which, now, didn't they have to move that house?
Yes, they did move that house. It was in another part. It was actually in downtown Meridian. And then because of, you know, development issues, the Historic Society that owns Mary Hope really wanted to save this particular house because it was the home of two leading citizens who had contributed a lot to the town or the city of Meridian. So they did move the entire structure to the back of the property of Mary Hope that they already owned and opened for tours.
Wow.
Yeah. So for our listeners who are keeping score at home, if you want to see a photo of what the gingerbread house looks like, Google the Frank W. Williams home, and you will also find it along with the historical page of Mary Hope Mansion.
Right, which we will talk about later.
Yeah, for those who are, you know, want a little more assistance, all of the addresses for the sites that are in the book are in the back of my book, and there's also a picture, at least one picture of every site in the book. So I do try and include as many pictures as I can. I do try and include where there is a portrait of the ghost. I do try and include that as well. So they can Google some, but also if they have the book, they will be able to actually see what we're talking about.
All right.
Now, the interesting architecture about this house is it has an elevator in it, which mm-hmm. I did not think was that common.
It wasn't. And like I said, the husband built it specifically for his wife after she could no longer get around. So it was installed after the fact. It wasn't built originally with the house.
And that, I'm sure the elevator was put in somewhere in the early 1900s, maybe?
Yeah, and it's actually out in the, as you go up to the second floor landing, it's actually out in the hall. And when you go there today, I'm assuming it's still that way, I haven't been back in a couple of years, there is a padlock on it. So there is, it's not used anymore, and it's like with this big heavy padlock on it, which is what caught my eye, because when I took the tour, no one had said anything about a ghost of Mamie being in the house. What caught my eye when I was out in the hall was this padlock. And so I asked the guide, you know, basically, what's with the padlock? Like, what's behind this door? And then she shared the story with me of the very tragic thing that had happened to Mamie later on in life.
Wow.
So it was one of the older style elevators where it was actually a door and then the gate?
Yes, it was the door, and then, you know, you open the door and then you push the gate. You push the grate open. And if it, not having been in it, I can't tell you exactly the size, but it doesn't seem like it was made for more than one occupant at a time.
Gotcha.
Had to be big enough for a wheelchair.
Right. And it's interesting that when I did take the tour, there was another couple that was, there were three of us. And again, the couple knew nothing about there being a ghost in the property. And when we were downstairs in the library, the husband didn't want to linger there. He just kept, he was very annoyed. He was kind of grumbling. And then when we went up to the second floor, it was the wife who was acting very uncomfortable. And finally he said something about, something really bad's happened here, hasn't it? And I was really startled, and the guy was as well, to hear her say that. And she just really did not want to continue with the tour anymore. She just really wanted to be out of the tour. And I followed them outside afterwards and kind of told them what I was doing and that I was writing a book. And could they tell me, or could she tell me, you know, what was wrong? And she just reiterated, I just had a bad feeling when I was up on the second floor. I didn't like it. They were from Wisconsin. She said, we don't have ghosts. We don't believe in ghosts. All I know is I just don't want to be out of here, and please don't use our names. Like, okay.
Boy.
So whatever she was feeling was very, very strong and made her so uncomfortable, she just had to get out of the house.
Wow.
But on the other hand, I didn't feel that at all. I mean, yes, I was shocked to hear the story of poor Mamie, but I didn't feel like, oh, this is a very oppressive ghost that's here, you know, or this house is very oppressive. The only thing that one felt was, because the rooms were smaller, and as I mentioned, the windows were small, the house did feel a little claustrophobic. And they do keep in the house a lot of the possessions. A lot of Mamie's clothes are still there, which I found charming because, you know, when you walk through the bedroom, you are looking at it as if she had just stepped out of the room. So I found that charming, but obviously the other woman on the tour did not feel it was quite so charming.
Well, now, the child that they adopted, she willed the house to that child who took it over after she had died because the husband didn't want to stay there anymore.
Right. Very proper gentleman. Didn't feel it was correct to be staying in a house, even though Daisy told him it would be fine to be staying in a house with an unmarried woman. And so he moved out.
Yeah. And she never did marry. She lived to be 104.
Yeah. Yeah. Incredible. Yeah, we think people are living a long time now. There are a lot of people who did pretty well. Even, you know, considering that the diets and the lifestyle might not have been quite as healthy as today, it wasn't all that unusual for someone to live that long.
So I assume she was the last one that actually lived in the house then.
Yes, she was the last one to live in the house.
So no other families other than just the husband, wife, and then their adopted daughter.
Right.
That's pretty interesting, all those years. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and it was actually kind of sweet to hear the story of the husband and his wife, that, you know, that they, from all accounts, were very, very much in love, treated each other very kindly throughout their life, were very, you know, caring about each other's needs. You know, the fact that he went ahead and, you know, built an elevator so that she could get up and down and she could go back to her own bedroom instead of just trying to, you know, create some bedroom out of the library or something downstairs. So that to me said a lot about them. So to me, it was more a house of love than anything else.
Wow. I think we're going to go ahead and take our last break. And this one's not going to be a real long one because we've got some other great stories we want to try and get in tonight. So I guess, let's see, Barbara took us out the last time. Kat, you want to take us out and I'll bring us back?
Sure. So everyone, you are listening to The Paranormal View with your hosts, Henry Foister, Jeffrey Gould, Barbara Duncan, and myself, Kat Kloko. Tonight we have on this show Barbara Sillery for her third appearance on The Paranormal View, and we are talking about her book, The Haunting of Mississippi. More to come after the break.
Hi, this is Mike from Mr. G's Ice Cream Store in Gettysburg, the most haunted ice cream store in town. Stop in and see us next time you're around. We feature 16 flavors of homemade ice cream made right here in the store. Look forward to seeing you.
There's a darkness in the hallway. Voices that seem to come from nowhere. Alone at night, there is a feeling that something or someone is near. Where can you go? Who can you turn to? Para-X Radio and the all-new Para-X Vision can help. Our knowledgeable host and expert guest can help you find some answers and take a glimpse into the unknown. Para-X Radio and Para-X Vision. Programming for the open mind.
My name is Greg Bakken. I'm a writer, a producer, and a paranormal investigator. My favorite way of communicating with spirits is through using the spirit box, also known as a ghost box. I invite you to listen to me every Wednesday at 10 p.m. Central for interviews with people in the paranormal community and beyond. Plus, I will also include as much of my spirit box evidence as I can during my show.
My name is Greg. Can you say Greg? Can you say Jeff?
Right. Jeff.
Join me every Wednesday at 10 p.m. Central Time for Minnesota Ghost Box, only on Para-X Radio.
Rhett, where are you going?
I'm going back to the Paranormal View, back where I belong.
Please, take me with you.
No, I'm through with everything here. I want to see if there's something left in life I haven't explored. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, Rhett, don't run to them. They talk about ghosts and hauntings, UFOs and all kinds of supernatural scary stuff.
You'll never understand, will you, Scarlet?
No.
Well, that's your misfortune.
Rhett, if you go, where shall I go? What shall I do?
Frankly, my dear... Line.
You gotta be kidding.
That's The Paranormal View with your host, Henry Foister, Jeffrey Gould, Kat Kloko, and Barbara Duncan. Every Saturday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, exclusively on the Para-X Radio Network.
They're creepy and they're kooky, mysterious and spooky. They all talk gobbledygooky, the Para-X family. The shows are paranormal, not stuffy but informal. The topics are abnormal, the Para-X family.
They're strange, deranged, unrestrained.
So grab your favorite brew, it's time to rendezvous, as we give awards to the Para-X family.
And welcome back, everybody, right here to the Paranormal View on the Para-X Radio Network. I want to thank everybody for being here tonight. Lots of people here in the chat room and lots of people listening from around the world. We appreciate each and every one of you. Want to remind you, if you do have questions, you can private chat them to either Ceiling Cat, co-host Cat, or myself, Henry Foister. We will get those questions right over to our guest. And if you're listening from somewhere else around the world and you have questions, you can still send us a question to theparanormalview@gmail.com and just put attention question and we will get that answered for you. I want to welcome back Barbara and Kat. Barbara. Yeah. Okay.
We sound like a law firm representing the dearly departed.
Yeah, there you go.
Hello, you have reached Barbara, Barbara and Cat, here for all your afterlife needs. Please leave a message after the beep.
We are busy with a ghost at the moment, but we'll get back to you as soon as we're done.
Yeah, exactly.
Our show is known as the ghost with the most.
So there's
about three other ones that I'd like to try and get in because I know there's going to be a lot to them.
Yes.
And I think one of them was what you guys were talking about before is Glen Burnie.
Yes. Oh. I like this one because I'm such our listeners know I'm into crime history, and this one was just right up my alley. So
this one is incredible. I mean, you have the oddest of odd couples. This takes place back in the source of it started back in the 1930s, and you just have this. When they told me the story the first time, I actually was at Glen Burnie with the current owner of Glen Burnie, and then she brought her mother over to the house, and her mother had been the previous owner. And, of course, they are talking about the two ghosts they have there that they say is Jeannie Merrill and Duncan Miner. Not knowing anything about them, I was like, okay, why are you so excited about this? And then they start telling me about the murder of Jeannie Merrill and all of the people that they suspected of her murder, and it is just the most convoluted murder case that many people in Natchez, even though someone was arrested and was put in prison, many people in Natchez today do not believe they got the right person and believe that the murder was never solved.
Right.
So it's absolutely fascinating.
I do want to note for our listeners that the chapter title is called Glen Burnie, A Tangled Tale of Murder, Goats, and Ghosts. Yes. That was just enough to get my attention with the word goats. I was just like, what?
I could have written the whole book. And actually, some people believe that the cause of the murder, the reason for the murder, was the goats. That Jeannie was murdered because of the goats that Olivia Dockery owned. So you have Jeannie living in her family mansion, Glen Burnie. She was a debutante, beautiful woman, as you can see from the pictures in the book. Her father was ambassador to Belgium, so she was this international debutante. And then when her father dies, she sort of goes into a depression and becomes a recluse. And the only person that she allows in her house is her second cousin, Duncan Miner, who has also come from a very wealthy aristocratic family. When you see his portrait, I mean, very striking-looking young man. And, again, just unbelievable gossip about them, that these two were either secretly married or were secret lovers, because Duncan, every night until Jeannie died, would ride his bicycle over to her house and spend the night. So, you know, of course, there's this gossip about second cousins. There's this speculation about what's going on over there. And then in the neighboring plantation that's called Glenwood, there lives another sort of eccentric man by the name of Dick Dana. And there's nothing about this case that's normal. Somehow or other, he's a bachelor. A friend of his convinces him, I think she's dying, that he should be the guardian for her younger sister. So he accepts. So there's Dana living in this house with Olivia. They're not related. There is Jeannie, who has her midnight visitor, Duncan, her second cousin. And while Jeannie and Duncan are doing well money-wise, Olivia and Dick Dana are not. And so Olivia tries to come up with all these ways to generate income. She starts growing vegetables, and then she starts raising goats. And the problem becomes that neither Dick nor Olivia, I guess one would call them hoarders again, kept things up. the goats were constantly getting out, and they were crossing through the woods and getting onto Jeannie's property. Jeannie was not happy about it, said to have even gotten a shotgun and would shoot at the goats. And then one night in 1932, the police are called, and they get to Glen Burnie, and there's blood everywhere. They can't find Jeannie. There is a huge search all over the grounds. Duncan, Jeannie's second cousin, comes. They all go searching, and finally one of the searchers finds Jeannie's body on the property, and she's been shot. She's dead. And immediately, because of the feud between Jeannie and Olivia, the suspects for killing Jeannie are Olivia and Dick on the neighboring property, living in the goat with the goats. And by the way, these goats were known to run through the house. They ate the books in the house. They were just, you know, just use the house however they felt like it. So Olivia and Dick are suspected. When the police arrive, Dick is apparently, according to the newspaper reports, washing blood off of his shirt. He is wearing a bloody shirt. They didn't really have DNA, but there's an analysis of the blood at the time. And somehow in the report, it turns out it's not human blood, it's pig's blood. So he's exonerated. Olivia is exonerated. And in the meantime, the sheriff of Natchez gets a call from a sheriff in Arkansas who says they had just arrested a black man by the name of George Pearl. He had a revolver with him. And again, miraculously, somehow or other, the bullets from this revolver matched the bullets that are in Jeannie. So they want to arrest him, except he is shot. He's dead. And then this woman comes forward and says that he was her boarder and that she and George Pearls, the black man, had gone to Jeannie and were trying to get money out of Jeannie. Nobody really explains why or why Jeannie would give them money, whether they were trying to rob her or they had some scam. It's never really clear. And so she is tried. She is put in jail. She's sentenced to jail for the murder, and then she's pardoned, and she's out of jail. So the whole murder scenario, and so it's never really proven why Jeannie has been murdered. And the murder takes place at Glen Burnie, and when I was interviewing Carolyn Guido and her mother, they both believe that they have seen Jeannie in the house. Carolyn's daughter says she has seen the spirit of Jeannie in the house, and they've had many dinner parties there, and one of the dinner guests claimed that she had seen a man in the house who she describes looking very much like the portrait of Duncan Miner. So just this convoluted, unbelievable tale.
Wow. Now, if we're going to let you tell everybody toward the end of the show where they can get this book. It's really fascinating stories in it, so you need to get it and add it to your library. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm going to say it's very, very easy. You can get it at most independent bookstores. You can get it through Barnes & Noble. You can go onto Amazon.com. They have it as both an ebook and in the print version, so you can order it through Amazon. You can order it through my publisher, which is Pelican Publishing. So very easy to find. Just Google The Haunting of Louisiana and you'll find it. Oh, I'm sorry, The Haunting of Mississippi.
Mississippi. Do you know where you're at tonight?
Yeah, there's too many ghosts in my life. Just trying to keep them all straight and keep them in the right locations.
There's another one I know Barbara is also wanting to talk about, and it's a place that was built in 1789 called King's Tavern.
Oh, Alluring Madeline.
Yes,
yeah.
Madeline.
Yeah, they're not even sure if this portrait that hangs in King's Tavern is Madeline. but they use it to tell Madeline's story, and kind of a tragic tale, but also, again, very fascinating. King's Tavern is now a bar and restaurant in Natchez, quite popular, a little casual. You don't have to get all dressed up. I don't even think you need reservations to go there. And in the tavern itself, over the fireplace, hangs this portrait of a woman that's referred to as Alluring Madeline. She is the ghost of King's Tavern. She's the primary ghost of King's Tavern. And I think it was, I'm trying to think, it was the third owners, the postal waits, when they owned the building and they were using it as a private home, they realized that a lot of the bricks in the home were crumbling. And so they called in workmen to restore the bricks, especially around the fireplace. And when they were taking the bricks out, they actually found the skeletons of three people that were later identified as female and two males. Prior to finding of the skeletons, there had always been these legends in throughout Natchez oral tradition that the very first owner of King's Tavern was married and had taken the young waitress that worked there at the tavern for his mistress, but that his wife was clearly not very happy about it, and that she shot the waitress. And so this story has continued over the years. When they found the skeletons, then, of course, people speculated that this was Madeline, who had been murdered by the wife of the original owner, and then she had bricked up her body, you know, behind the wall. So then it was like, well, okay, but there's three skeletons that they found behind this wall. And so another theory is that the owner herself didn't actually kill Madeline, but she hired two assassins to do it, and that these assassins, once they did the job, then she killed them. So she was a pretty busy lady if she managed to, you know, have Madeline killed, and then she kills the other two guys, and then she bricks them up inside the building. Again, it's always fun when you're trying to go backwards in time and figure out who did what to whom and who might be the ghost that's still lingering about. But that is the popular story that is told about Madeline, that she was murdered and that her body was up behind the wall, and that today Madeline has come back to King's Tavern. She's sort of a troublesome spirit. She will tug at the tablecloth, at your tablecloth. She's been known to rattle a chain that hangs over in the corner. There is a bedroom on the second floor, because the tavern was also used for overnight guests, that they have made up, and they call it Madeline's room, although it's of the wrong time period. But they claim that often if you go up there, you will see that the bed is messed up, that Madeline's ghost has laid down on it, so that this is proof that she's still there. So just, you know, layers upon layers of who Madeline is, how she died, and, you know, who killed her.
Now, while you were talking, we heard talking in the background.
I'm not sure it was talking. It could have been your stomach.
No, it wasn't mine.
It was just an unknown noise. Are there any frogs?
No, I could actually hear talking in the background.
Interesting. I don't hear any talking on this end.
No, it was just quick. It's not now. It was just
okay.
A short amount of time.
But, yeah. And if our listeners heard it, especially on playback, please email us in and let us know. But Henry, Cece, and I all heard it.
Yeah. Well, they heard it in the chat room, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. My guess is it's the Loveland Frogman, Henry. You're the closest to the Loveland Frogman. It had to be him.
No, it was not me.
I'm just pulling your leg.
Well, the King's Tavern, Madeline is not the only one who is supposed to be murdered there. So it doesn't have the greatest reputation in terms of what's happened. And to me, the most gruesome story associated with it is King's Tavern was right along the Natchez Trace, in which there were known, you know, highwaymen and robbers were known to hang out along the Natchez Trace. And there were two that were called the Harp Brothers, Big Harp and Little Harp, and they were said to be, you know, the worst of the worst, extremely cruel. And the owner at the time, Tom Miller, tells me of a legend of King's Tavern also served as sort of like the post office drop for the whole entire Natchez territory, and that there was a woman there picking up her messages. She had a baby in her arms. The baby was crying, and Big Harp walked in, and he couldn't stand the baby crying, and so he grabbed the baby out of the woman's hands and took the baby and swung it up against the wall and crushed its skull. So, I mean, pretty horrific, and people, diners in the restaurant today say that there are times, at a certain spot there's a wall where there's two tables, and they say if you have a table by that wall, you from time to time can hear the baby crying.
So, oh, man.
Yeah, now- so not very, very nice. And then there's a third story that, you know, obviously this was Native American territory, and by the time Europeans moved in and started building these buildings, Native Americans were considered the lowest of the low, and so they were not allowed inside of King's Tavern. The third legend associated with it is that sometimes if you were looking out the window, which is where the former front door was, you will see this Native American in full regalia staring and trying to come inside. And in the postscript to this story, I do mention that I have a friend, his name is Greyhawk. He is Choctaw and Homa, very good friend of mine. And when I was researching the story and telling him about King's Tavern, he said, oh yeah, I go to Natchez for the annual powwow. And he said, I did go one evening to King's Tavern to, you know, go have dinner. And he said, I was with some friends, and the waitress told us the story about Madeline, hard to miss because there's her big portrait up there, and said that, you know, you can go upstairs and you can, you know, look at this room they call Madeline's bedroom. And so after dinner, he said, well, yeah, he was going to go upstairs and take a look. And he said when he put his hand on the railing of the staircase to go upstairs, he felt a heavy pressure as if another hand was trying to hold his hand down and keep him from going upstairs. He did go upstairs, he did look, but he said when he left the restaurant that evening and he looked down on his hand, he said there were welts in the shape of four fingerprints on the top of his hand.
Wow. Wow.
And like I've known Greyhawk probably 25, 30 years, and when Greyhawk tells me something, I believe him. So he wasn't telling me this just to entertain me. This was something that actually happened to him.
I've heard of this tavern talked about before, and those two brothers. And it must be just a horribly active place. Do they let ghost hunters visit? Or I should say paranormal investigators?
Tom Miller, the owner that was there when I did the interview, did. I can't tell you about the new owner. It's owned, I understand, by a woman, so I don't know what her policy is. But I do know that Tom talked very freely about all of the legends associated with King's Tavern. And these are not legends that are they're very, very well known throughout Natchez. I mean, if you say King's Tavern to anyone who lives in Natchez, they will start telling you stories.
Hmm.
Wow. And I know our listeners are just kind of stunned at the idea of somebody getting walled into a building.
Right. And, you know, sometimes you think, oh, these are only in fiction. You know? This does not happen in real life. But this is well documented. The postal waits, the workers did find skeletons in the wall.
Yeah.
Whether it's Madeline or not, you know, there's no way after all this time to be able to prove that. Plus, you know, no one knows what happened to Madeline. We don't have DNA from Madeline. We don't know, you know, if she was buried somewhere else. There's no way of proving it.
Right.
But, you know, the association over time that this was Madeline, because here was this story that had been circulating throughout Natchez for probably 100 years, and then in the 1930s, they find these skeletons.
Wow.
So people just immediately, of course, make a connection.
Stories, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the only stories I ever heard about people being walled in were in, like, Holyrood House and old English and Scottish castles.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, I find it hard to believe that the owner's wife was able to pull all this off without anyone knowing what she was doing. I mean, in a wall in three skeletons, three bodies, it seems like an enormous task for one woman to do. But, you know, that is the legend.
Well, let's talk about Waverly, and I don't mean Waverly Hills in Kentucky. We're talking about Waverly Plantation.
Yeah, in West Point, Mississippi.
Yes.
The day that I was supposed to go there, my GPS was not cooperating whatsoever. I got totally lost. I could not find this place. I drove all the way back to Columbus, Mississippi, and had to get directions again. So, and then even as I'm coming down this rural road, and I'm thinking, there is no big mansion here, and I'm looking, and I'm looking, and I'm looking, and then through the trees, because this is very heavily wooded in the area, I see this cupola peeking up around the top of from the top of the trees, and I finally reached my destination. So this is one that I almost gave up on, because I couldn't find it. I literally couldn't find it.
Now, they talk about the mirrors there, and they see a lot of things in the mirrors.
Right. There is it's called a pier mirror, which is a very tall, narrow mirror where, you know, the ladies would be able to check their ball gowns. So it's in the room that would have been used as the ballroom. And during one ball that was being held there, according to the legend, the mirror just cracked. Nobody hit it. It just somehow cracked. But if you look in this mirror today, and if you keep your eyes on it really well, they say that sometimes you can actually see the dancers that had been in this glorious ballroom and enjoying themselves. You can see little flickers of the gowns and the men's and the tuxedos. So it's sort of like an early television. But the house, Waverly itself, obviously once it was this glorious, wonderful mansion used for parties, entertainments, lavishly furnished. And then, obviously, after the Civil War, when many of these places fell into ruins for lack of money, this one sat abandoned. And it became sort of the lover's lane for the area. And it became known by a lot of the sororities and fraternities in the area that, you know, you either go there and, you know, see the ghosts that are there, or you go there and you hang out and you drink. And there are old photographs, of Waverly, where there was sort of a, like a barrel that was put in the middle of this ballroom by a lot of these teenagers and people in their 20s that hung out there, and they would actually make a fire in the ballroom, putting wood into this barrel as they sat around at night and drank and told ghost stories and did whatever they did. And when you think about it, this entire wooden structure with a fire being set almost on a nightly basis, that it didn't burn to the ground like many of them have done, is just incredible. And the Snow family today that owns Waverly believe that it was the ghosts, especially a little girl ghost, who protected the house and somehow kept these fires that they were burning from spreading. And she is responsible for Waverly being there today, that without her protection, the house would not be there.
Wow. And there's also a bed, supposedly, where the little girl takes naps on.
Yeah, up in the second floor. Not all the rooms are furnished, but up on the second floor, there are several of the bedrooms. There's a big four-poster bed, and Melanie Snow, who is the current owner, says that they will go into that room. They will straighten the covers for the tours, and they will, once the tour starts and they go into the room, they will see that the covers have been disturbed, and that it is almost the indentation of a little girl's body, as if this little ghost had climbed up in the bed and was taking a nap.
And there's also a portrait that hangs in the house where the whole head supposedly turns.
And it happened to me. I think it would be the sort of the quasi-library of the house, huge room. The woman who actually, and her husband, who actually restored the house was Melanie Snow's mother, Donna Snow. And she and her husband moved there when Melanie was a little girl. And as they lived there, they began the restoration of Waverly. When Donna died, they had this gorgeous portrait of her painted, and they hung it in the room. And it has happened with other older portraits. I've never seen it happen with a modern portrait. But somehow, the artist was able to paint her face in such a way that no matter where you stand in the room, her eyes are looking at you. And I did it. You know, I stood over in one corner, and Donna's staring at me. I stand in the middle of the room, Donna's staring at me. I move over to the other side of the room, and Donna is staring at me. And I'm like, how is this possible? I mean, I can't understand how you can paint a technique where the eyes move. But no matter where you stand in the room, she's staring at you.
It would be really neat to take a film camera in there and set it up and see if, from one perspective, have somebody walk back and forth to see if the eyes move.
All I know is, I did not have a video camera with me at the time because I was doing research for the book and never expected to find something like this. I mean, again, I've heard the logical explanation that it is in the painting technique, and I usually try when I'm doing research and there's some incident or some talk about there's a ghost or some poltergeist activity, I always do the devil's advocate thing. I try and find out, either through my own research or by consulting experts, that there's a logical explanation for whatever the phenomena is. And the explanation I've been given for this is that it is a technique that the artist used. Mm-hmm. How, I don't know, because it does not compute with me at all.
It's also a good technique to set somebody up for a real good scare later.
Yeah.
Well, of course.
Yeah, it's moving.
The interesting thing is it's not meant to be a scary picture. It is an absolutely beautiful picture of a beautiful woman. You know, there's nothing frightening about it until you realize that the eyes are following you. No matter where you are, the eyes are. So, and Melanie just sort of chuckles about it. She thinks it's fun and it's interesting, and she likes all the attention that it continues to bring to her mother, because she's very, very grateful to her mother for what she was able to accomplish in saving this house. Because it doesn't seem like, unless the Snows actively pursued buying this place and restoring it bit by bit by bit, and they were not wealthy people, we would not have a Waverly today. And what's unusual about it is the shape of the house. It's an octagonal house. So it's not like your normal plantation house. It's a total surprise when you see it.
Wow. You know, our time is quickly running right on past. 2 hours just doesn't seem to stay around for us much. It goes by very quick. There's three or four others that we'd like to try and get to, but we ain't going to be able to. There's one that I wanted to ask about, and it's called, and I'm sure a lot of people's heard about it, it's called Nutt's Folly. Has that been restored, or is it the same way it was when?
No, it was a condition of the last owner that when he gave it to the Natchez Pilgrimage, Natchez Pilgrimage Society, that it remained unfinished. It was never to be completed. So while the outside, the exterior, is finished, the only floor that's finished is actually the basement. So again, a very eerie experience to go through this mansion and go through all of these rooms, and they're just, you know, scaffolding and bare walls, and you can look from the first floor all the way up to the cupola, because there are stairs going up, just unfinished wooden stairs, but the rooms are not finished. There's no wallboard, there's no plaster on the walls, there's no furniture. It was left exactly the way it was when Mr. Nutt died.
And
the only thing,
The family lived in the basement part of the house, right?
Lived in the basement, but this was at the start of the Civil War, and it was called Nutt's Folly because all of the neighbors, given the current political climate, thought that Mr. Nutt was crazy for trying to build something like this at a time when, you know, obviously the country was going to be going into a civil war. He ignored their advice. He didn't think that the war would last very long if there was a formal war, and so he continued. And then when civil war was declared, he had the workmen, got them to stay. Well, the main workmen actually left. When they left, and you go into the rooms, their buckets are still there, their tools are still there. They left, went back up north, and he managed to convince a few local workmen to finish the basement and make the bedrooms in the basement, make a living room in the basement, so that when you're in the basement level, it doesn't seem like you're in a basement. I mean, it's totally furnished, it's totally livable, and you kind of forget that there's all these floors above you that are not finished. And the main ghost, of course, is Mr. Nutt himself. And he's back because, you know, this is his house and he's keeping an eye on it and probably very curious to who all these people are that are just pouring through in droves looking at his mansion.
It's pretty interesting.
And
it's a shame, you know, that after he died, his family still lived there in the basement until such time that they couldn't no longer stay there. I guess they had to leave because they didn't have the money for taxes and stuff.
Right, right. The other interesting thing that I discovered by accident, I was walking around the grounds and I saw this little path, and I took the path and I actually came upon the family cemetery. So there's where Mr. Nutt, Taylor Nutt, is buried. His wife is buried there. His children are buried there. So it's quite touching because now you're actually looking at the graves of all of the people that lived in the house, that lived in this basement.
Wow. Now, that's something that, and you have stories about the cemeteries toward the end of the book, which is something Barbara really is into.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just
Go ahead, Barbara.
I was just going to say it was amazing. I didn't see any mort safes there, but you were talking in the book briefly about how some of them are in disarray and people are going in and disturbing the stones.
Yeah, well, the one at Waverly, which is actually across the road from the mansion itself, I mean, I was really shocked to see that the coverings over the slabs, the in-ground ones, have been pushed aside. Some are cracked. Their crosses are knocked over to the point where they have put up signs and asked people to be respectful that this is a family cemetery. They don't mind people coming to visit, but not to vandalize. So I really was shocked at that. I'm just such a huge advocate of historic preservation because I believe that when the physical evidence is gone, whether it's a grave or it's a house or it's a barn, we tend to forget what's happened there. We tend to forget about the people that live there. So to me, it's those physical things are really, really important. So when you see, you know, a grave being vandalized, it just really breaks your heart. It's like, not only are you desecrating this grave, but you're destroying history. You're destroying all of our collective heritage. You know, you're making it difficult for us to learn about all these people that came before and set the way for us now.
Very much.
Wow. Yeah.
Very much so. I can't remember, I think it was George Washington or if it was Benjamin Franklin who said, you can tell the level of a culture by how they treat their dead.
Sort of in that same vein, when I was doing The Haunting of Louisiana, I was interviewing a Catholic moral theologian about, you know, the Catholic stance on ghosts and spirits and, you know, whether they think people from the dead can come back. And he looked at me and he said, Barbara, it's not the dead you have to be afraid of. It's the living.
Very much so.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I know they do have grave slabs there. And I don't think they have mort safes. At least I didn't see very many in some of the photographs I've seen of southern graves.
No, and it depends. To me, southern graves are kind of a mixture. You know, in New Orleans, there is the cities of the dead, the above-ground tombs, these miniature, you go to Metairie Cemetery and you'll see like a miniature castle. You'll see an Egyptian pyramid. I mean, these things are unbelievably elaborate, the way they bury their dead. And up in New England, when I was researching the haunting of Cape Cod and the islands, I was kind of disappointed because, you know, the gravestones are very, very simple, very, very few statues, rare to find a statue. And the contrast between the South and New England in terms of cemeteries and the types of ways that they bury the dead are extreme opposite ends on how it's done.
Wow.
Yep, I can back that up.
Yeah.
You can back that up.
And I love going to cemeteries because, you know, when there is a grave and when you can read the inscription on it, these are just wonderful stories that make you want to learn more. Like, who was this person? Oh, look, here's a little child's grave. This child only made it to 3 years old. Oh, wait a minute. Here's four children, all with the same surname, and none of them made it past the age of 10. Like, what happened here? You know, was this yellow fever? You know, were this just childbirth? What's going on? So, you know, to lose those things, it's just so sad to me.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Every stone is a life. And a history behind it, and some of them are just amazing.
And that's what I think is so great about haunted tales and ghost stories, because they get people interested in the past. They bring the past into the present, and they make the past come alive again. So the past is no longer just a name or a date. You know, now you really connect because these are real people that once lived, and they did this, and they made this mistake, or they built this beautiful mansion, or it didn't get to be finished, or, you know, it makes you want to learn about the past. So for me, finding more ghost stories, preserving ghost stories, preserving the history of these people, I'm just absolutely fascinated with ghost stories. They're not something to be dismissed, something to just be used for Halloween, or, you know, there are a lot of places where you really only hear tales about spirits around Halloween. It's thought of something more that a child would do as opposed to an adult being involved in.
Yeah. And there is a lot more stories in this book that we don't have time to actually get to tonight, such as Magnolia Hall. That's a excellent stories there. And we didn't even get to talk about Tupelo, Mississippi. Elvis Presley.
Yeah. Everybody, I recommend if you want to go to a museum, go to Tupelo, Mississippi with Elvis's birthplace. You will be blown away. It is one of the best museum complexes I have ever been at. They do such a phenomenal job. And most of the people that go there truly, truly believe that when they are there, they can connect with Elvis's spirit much more than going to Graceland.
Wow. Have you guys got any other quick questions for Barbara?
There was one from chat from Kat from about an hour ago. It's a quick one. And she asks, has she seen shadow people?
Well, I'm not exactly sure what she means by shadow people, if it's just something out of the corner of my eye. I've certainly listened to many, many people tell me they have seen a shadow or just something fleeting passed by.
Mm-hmm.
I've certainly heard, and there was one time I wasn't even working on a ghost book. I wasn't working on a ghost documentary. I was actually working on a documentary about Creole architecture when I saw a woman that so clearly, but the odd thing about it is that I had someone, a cameraman and an audio guy, standing on either side of me. We were shooting an interview when this woman stuck her head through the window, and I was the only one who saw her. And she was as real to me as anyone else I would meet on the street. And I cannot explain why, with three pairs of eyes, all looking in the same place, which was right behind the person we were interviewing, I'm the only one who saw her in the window, poking her head through, and no one else saw her.
And so, the camera didn't pick it up either.
Well, it's one of those issues where I work a lot with the same cameraman, and we have this thing that we start an interview off on a wide shot, and then as the interview goes on, he pushes into a close-up. By the time we pulled the tape out afterwards, because when we were driving back to the station, I had said to them, oh, it's a good thing you were on a close-up when that woman stuck her head through the window. And both the camera guy and the audio guy told me they didn't know what I was talking about. And I thought I'd proved them wrong, and we got back to the station, and I put the tape in, queued it up to the place, because I knew what the gentleman was talking about during the interview when I saw the woman in the window, queued it up to that spot on the tape. And unfortunately for me, we were in on a close-up, so the window was no longer in the shot. However, on the backup audio, when it was happening, when I saw the woman in the window, I had turned and whispered to my cameraman, and my voice was caught on the camera mic, and I was saying to him, is she in the shot? Is she in the shot? And when he didn't respond, I assumed he was in on a close-up. But when we played the tape and we went to the backup audio track, you can hear me saying, is she in the shot? Is she in the shot? So clearly at that moment, I was seeing something. Why they didn't see it, I can't explain it.
Wow. Well, our time is just about run out. I want to thank you for taking the time to be with us tonight. I want you to give out where your books are, your sites and everything, and then we want you to stay until after we're off.
Okay. Well, my site is my name, Barbara Sillery, S-I-L-L-E-R-Y. And you can reach me, BarbaraSillery@gmail.com. My books are available, as I said before, any independent bookstore. You can go to Amazon. They're on sale on Amazon, and you can also order them as ebooks. So you have your choice of how to get them. And so it's The Haunting of Louisiana, Haunting of Mississippi, and my newest one in that series, The Haunting of Cape Cod and the Islands. And I'd love to hear from everyone.
All right. Well, Kat, won't you give out all our stuff real quick?
Sure. So you can find all of our information, everyone, at theparanormalview.com. It has all the host information. Also, we are on iTunes. Please find our podcast, like, subscribe, and write a review. It will help other people like you find this wonderful show. And next week, it is another listener request show about Great Lakes ghosts.
Yes, it is. And we're also now have shows over on YouTube. Just go to YouTube and look up The Paranormal View. I think we got about 7 of our shows over there, and I will be putting more up. I've been real busy this week and wasn't able to get anything done, so we will get more done. And Barbara, you got anything to say before we run?
Nope.
I just want to thank you all for having me again for the third time. It's been a pleasure. And I will definitely try and download this interview from YouTube and put it up on my Facebook page, put it up on the website, barbarasillery.com. And once again, thank you, and thank you to all of your listeners.
Yay.
And Cece?
Yep. Let's go.
All right.
Okay.
Well, until next week, we want to thank you for taking time to be with us. And until then, this is Henry Foister.
Barbara Duncan.
And Kat Cloco.
We'll see you next week at the same time. So good night, everybody.